This is the Propanon Podcast. Tune in.
Open your fucking ears, jackass.
Here we are, right?
Grant Morrison is a Scottish comics writer, Hollywood screenwriter, executive producer, and cat lover. For over four decades, his work has entertained and inspired millions of readers with his unique form of storytelling, making him one of the most popular writers in comics history. His list of bona fides is too long to name, but my favorites have been Arkham Asylum, Animal Man, Doom Patrol, The New X-Men, The Filth, The Invisibles, and his nonfiction book, Super Gods. Morrison's work is a testament to the Promethean urge in all of us to achieve our highest potential selves before shedding our mortal coils. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Grant three times before, but this is his first appearance on the Propanon Podcast. In this interview, we speak about Morrison's magical observations of the Trump regime, to which he asks, "Where are my invisibles?" as a rallying cry for others, Americans especially, to stand up to and defeat the rising tide of fascism in the world. Morrison is clear. Andrew Tate is a far cry from King Mob. And so it is time yet again for the left to get cooler, sexier, and tougher than those fascists trampling on our rights. We talk about how this phenomenon relates to the magical metaphor known as the Aeon of Mott, and how vital it is for us to increase our knowledge of magic. We also speak about the Invisibles and its spiritual sequel, The Filth. Morrison reveals his secrets behind the writing of that graphic novel, and how he uses writing as a powerful tool in his magical toolkit. We also speak about chaos magic, the holy guardian angel, and how Bast, the Egyptian cat goddess, is probably the most powerful deity in today's world. So without further ado, here's Grant Morrison.
So yeah, I mean, it's kind of like seeing a bit of a breakdown, like, you know, some kind of midlife crisis or something, and we're just hoping for the best. You know, really, it is. It's so chaotic and so nuts that there doesn't even seem to be a particularly powerful agenda behind anything apart from the most basic kind of crude racism and the usual bullshit. But it seems so like two-legged stool, you know. It's the weirdest thing I think we've seen happening historically for a long time. And I don't know how, I can explain it magically, obviously. We've talked about this before, and it just totally fits into the Crowley's idea of the Aeon of Horus. And that notion, you're the golden boy king, and there he is right there. He's still there, even though the flesh is failing. It's still the same boy king energy. And that's what we're dealing with right now. It's just destroying systems, smashing shit, you know, and that's exactly what Crowley said would happen at this time. And me and anyone else who's hoping for better tidings are hanging on for the Aeon of Mott, which kind of comes after, but it could come after 500 years. Who knows? It could come next week. We don't know. But at least for me, there's a context for everything that I can just kind of like, okay, something is playing out here and I know where it goes next, but I don't know when it goes.
Our first interview was during the first reign of the Orange Terror. And here we are again. Yeah, cycles in history. And yeah, like you just briefly mentioned that, like magically breaking down what that was. I really loved the way you framed it, because you know, with Trump being elected the first time, just sort of metaphorically, it was very poetic, you know, about like the attack on the Twin Towers and in 9/11. That was the manifestation of you know, the collapse of the 32nd path, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so we've been in it now.
No, it's magic, and the idea of magic is you're kind of seizing on that stuff and trying to enchant everything. So, you know, as again we've spoken before, it's really all about metaphor, and it's what are the metaphors that suit the current situation? And there's a whole bunch of them in magic that are really solid and coherent that I've found pretty helpful. So definitely, yeah. I mean, all those things you can see in the fall of the towers, that collapse of the path between, as we said before, it's the between what is real and what is imaginary. And it's the connecting path between Malkuth, the material world, and Yesod, the moon, which is the world of imagination, the astral plane, the inner life. And those two things were brought back together again. They were separate on the Tree of Life, But the collapse of it drew them together. And since that time, everything's been getting more and more weird and fictional. Fiction's getting more and more realistic, and realism gets more and more fictional. And we're surrounded by things that cause us to question reality itself, you know, from AI to deepfakes to all the stuff we talked about before, you know. It's, everything's about simulation, everything's about copying fake synthetic versions of everything else, you know, and now it's music and writing and everything's getting churned into it. So there's definitely a lot of interesting currents going around. And as a magician, I say the best way to deal with all that stuff is to find a way to integrate it into your system, you know, and see if you can work with it.
Interesting. Sort of like how the artist Joe Coleman would take a sip of poison every day to prepare for the world.
That's one way of doing it. I mean, Crowley apparently did that as well. He would take some dose of heroin, or he'd take some poison mixed in with something, you know. And there was the old the tarantula cults that used to get bitten by the tarantula and do the tarantella dance. So that toxin thing was quite popular. A little bit of what does you good.
Yeah, I mean, let's not speak too much about it. It might become the new rage. The new bath salt rage. Yeah, I mean, here we are, right? It's we're in like a Twilight Zone episode where we return back to this madness. And you know, the last time I guess this, just to quickly touch on this and keep it moving though, because I'm fascinated by this. Like, I mean, I guess it's just a tribute, it's an attribute to the Jim Jones ability that this guy has to, you know, create this political cult around him. Yeah. And then all the minions throughout. But what it took for him to get there, I mean, because the last time he was put in there, you know, people were talking about how, you know, the right wing had the magic and, you know, and the alt-right was the new punk rock. And I'm sorry, I never really believed that, except for the part, not the punk rock part, but what is this notion?
They were never punk rock.
No,
never punk rock, but certainly, yeah. The right took the magic, you know, from the 90s. Like I said, when I was doing the Invisibles, I was trying to make the left cool, because at the time, especially in Britain, we had these kind of shambolic politicians, you know, like Michael Foot and people who were leftist politicians, but they were kind of boring and woolly, and they kind of killed the fun of it for me. When I was a kid, it was all about protest and existentialists and students and ban the bomb and sort of cool stuff. So with the Invisibles, my notion was to try and cool up the left again, you know, and the kind of protest movement and that kind of thing. So my characters were all very fashion oriented, and they could do kung fu and all that stuff. And I kind of thought I was trying to present a model of a potential cool leftist, you know, someone who's learned how to fight, someone who's quite happy to take on the bad guys, someone who's intellectually rigorous, someone who's empathic and sympathetic and understanding and well-read. And it's a lot to be, you know, but I think that what happened was that the right took that figure, you know, and my King Mob from the Invisibles was kind of based on me in the 90s, that the shaved head, I was doing bunch of martial arts, I was meditating, I was doing all that stuff and traveling and reading a lot and doing magic. And I figured, well, there's a kind of role model figure, you know. And also I was doing very well with my writing and my career, so the magic was clearly working, things were going well, and it was very shiny. So for me, there was an attempt to put that across and say, here's what we can be. Here's how we win. We just be sexier than everybody else, and then they all want to be us. And that's what happened. The right took that. And that figure that was King Mob in the 90s became Andrew Tate. You know, the cage-fighting, bald guy who's like, and he's politically motivated, but it's all the wrong politics. And the guy's this kind of like, you know, stunted, not very, the kind of infantile politics, infantile thinking, infantile personality stuck at a level. And it's such a disappointment to me when I look at that. You know, we could have had 1,000 King Mobs, and he drives a Lamborghini and he does what he wants, you know. We could have had that guy, but Andrew Tate took that place, you know, that guy. So it's of interest to me how it was done, you know, and that we presented them a lot of things. Here's what you can do. Sigils work, magic works. This work. And they did it all, and they fucking, they changed the paradigm. And you got to accept that and look at it and see, okay, it was done. Now we've seen how easy it is to do it. We need to take that back because it started out as ours, you know. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I'm way too old for it these days, but we need an anti-Andrew Tate. We need this super cool fucker who can get in a cage and kick Andrew Tate's head in, you know. And he's on our side. And that's what I want to see. Where are those? Where are my invisibles, you know? And as I say, it's not for me to do anymore. I'm old. I've done my bit. I was been on the barricades long ago. And it's for young people to do this now, but not to just sit in rooms, not to just talk about punching Nazis and then Nazis take over the world while you're talking about punching Nazis. You know, we went out and we stopped the National Front. You know, other people went out and stopped the Nazi leagues in America or fought them in Europe. There was a lot of talking recently and then they took over while people were talking. So I'd like to see less of the talking, less of the infighting and maybe more of a coordinated, like, how do we become cooler and stronger and tougher than all of those people? And there's no reason why it shouldn't be possible. There's absolutely no reason at all. And Trump is where he is because he's a master magician. And what he has is charisma. It's the one thing that the people around him don't have. But Trump has genuine charisma. He's a golden monster, you know. I feel as if I could talk to that guy and find some strange something there that you could talk to. But the rest of them lack that. So his power lies in that he can just talk. It's like the anti-life equation in Jack Kirby. He just talks and people believe. That's the master magician. It's like dark side, you know. It's control of the human mind using pure words and the force of your self that you've created. So I think we need more of our side like that, and it's been less self-effacing and less, as I say, less infighty, less concerned about our ideological purity and more concerned about kicking some ass.
Would you say that the left needs to get their balls back?
Yeah, well, that's one way of saying it, maybe. I mean, and I'm probably... I'm very aware that shit goes on that I don't know about it. So I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are mobilized and motivated, and there's a bunch of them, like, I'm just waiting to hear from them. But from what I see, yeah, it would be nice to see a bit of that. And that from every sector of American life, you know, we need to see that within opposition parties in America. We need to see that within the judiciary and within the legal profession, and all the people that have been targeted need to kind of stand up a bit and stop taking it, because it's just magic. It's just wind. It's like, it's so far it's not crossed over into being a full-on authoritarian fist on the street thing. And it may yet go there, but right now there's still the chance to fight the magic with way better magic. And it's time people got out there, and it's time there were a few personalities. You know, Bernie Sanders can't do it on his own. There need to be more personalities. There need to be more charismatic people who are coming up and saying, nah, this is bullshit. This is old man bullshit, and we're not having it in America. This is not, we're not Russia. We're not, you know, America was founded by people running away from tyranny. And it's not like Russia, it's not like countries in Europe who succumbed to tyranny, because they'd lived under imperial rule for thousands of years. You know, America's a very different proposition. People ran away from being told what to do. And I really think that underlying that is that there's that strain of the American character that's got to start showing itself now, because I'm surprised that it's so timid at the minute. But I feel that I just don't see the USA putting up with this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a huge protest out here yesterday. Maybe it was worldwide, though. I think they said, like,
half. Yeah, I mean, I saw a bunch of them with protests in London. There was a whole bunch. you know, people are mobilized and motivated, but as I say, it needs some big personalities coming in, people who are super cool and who can take the stage and actually just blow everyone away with the facts and the force of personality and the force of, nah, here's how it is, here's how it's going to be.
Well, I, you know, in terms of like the media and say media magic, if you will, because algorithms seem like, you know, spells, little yeah. demons, you know, that one could put out there to get your, you know, do your willing, you know, and do your will. And I saw a chart the other day about like basically all the sort of personalities online, these YouTuber personalities and where they kind of sit on the spectrum left and right. And there's way more sort of, you know, I don't know, right wing voices are promoted way more online now. So it's like the internet became like, you know, right wing talk radio. Right.
Yeah.
And so this is the struggle. I mean, this is the struggle that so many like righteous artists face, is that they're not astroturfed by billionaire racist offs. You know what I mean? So they're not getting dark money under the table, you know, making their podcast reach, you know, best, you know, search engine optimization. They're struggling to get their voices out there, you know, and that seems to be always part of this. Right. Like maybe that's part of the heroic struggle of people coming together, because the weight of the world is heavier than before, you know, that's what it feels like. And isn't that the irony that, you know, this age that we're in, you know, could this be the, you know, I know you feel as if it might be like the dying gasps of the age of Horus into the Aeon of Mott. How long does this take?
Well, it could take a while. And what it is it's the dying of the age of Osiris. Mm. We haven't even got to Matt. You know, this is what Crowley predicted was the end of the Age of Osiris, which was the last 2,000 years. And it was based around the law and the word, basically. So everything in the Aeon of Osiris is about it's expressed through Bibles or Qurans or the Torah. You know, it's all about the word and the power of the word. And so that, the nature of that aeon was about structure. You know, I always say it's the pyramid. The big metaphorical representation of the aeon of Osiris is the pyramid. And it has that kind of Egyptian density, that heaviness and that solidity that was law, you know, and the notion of that you could carry your civilization through time and space by using the word, you know, and by setting down the rules and the commandments. They could influence people who hadn't even been born yet. And that's been basically what we had. That's what we call the patriarchy, because it was very much male-based. It was very different from our previous kind of more matriarchal approach to things. So this very masculine, word-based, progress-based, arrow into time-based future kind of... Crowley believed that it ended in, I think, 1903. But for me, as I said, it was that moment when the towers came down that I thought, okay, this is when it's really going to start. This is the actual moment where the change happens. So, yeah, all we've seen since then is through various agents is the collapse of structures that we all grew up with, you know, particularly from the post-war world. And since then, you've seen people, you know, like the president currently, just bringing down structures, bringing down systems, and you're watching it happen right now. And what's been attacked, it's the law, it's the word, the notion that the word expresses truth has been utterly devalued. The law is currently being devalued. Everything that gave the Aeon of Osiris its strength and its solidity is being evaporated right now and raised. And so the notion of the Aeon of Mott is what comes in once that raising is done. Because once the raising is done, these guys don't have anything to put in its place. You know, they don't have a blueprint, but Mott does. So how long does it take? We don't know. How much can the world take, you know, and still come back is where it all goes at this point, I think. Mm. Or can there be a sudden state change, as we know? You have a phase transition, which is the moment where liquid turns to steam, and it's liquid and it's bubbling and everything's out of control and it's in ferment and it's in turmoil, and suddenly, oh, it's steam. And all that craziness on the boundary just changes state. So we might be again, we might be on the boundary of something and the craziness just changes state, and suddenly instead of liquid, it's steam. But right now we're in the boiling phase, and I don't know how long it's going to take. I don't know how long it takes to boil this egg.
Yeah, man. Kind of feels like Humpty Dumpty rhyme right now. You know, The Invisibles was, you know, an iconic comic book and something that, you know, people still mention to me about how I felt about it too, about it was like another Illuminatus trilogy, you know. But another book of yours that, you know, you considered the sequel, which was still one of my favorites, and I don't hear many people talk about it, which I kind of like. This is like esoteric Morrison.
Yeah,
that's one of your favorites. You know, it's The Filth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's been, what, like almost 23 years since that book.
Pretty much, right? Yeah. God, yeah. But, so, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, if The Invisibles was my Illuminatus, then that was my Masks of the Illuminatus. You know, it's it's a shorter piece, but it's really dense, and it takes the themes and it kind of goes into them in a different way. And, yeah, I mean, I love The Filth. Filth is my favourite thing that I've ever done. It was the artist, Chris Weston. And it just hit on every level. It came after The Invisibles, and The Invisibles was the 90s, and it was this big kind of explosive, optimistic, futuristic, progressive thing. And it was really aimed at teenagers. You know, The Invisibles is for teenagers. It's to get you vibed up when you're young, you know. I don't know. But by that time, I'd hit 40, and I just thought, oh, I'm going to write something where it's just like, here's this. I was lucky enough that I'd hit 40 and I was having a great time because I just met Kristen and we were sort of running about having a kind of mad time around the world. So it was all very fun, which meant I could go to the dark places without any fear. And that's what The Filth was. And I just thought, I'll go to all the things that are terrifying, you know, like just aging and sickness and death and losing your animal and losing friends. And I'll just turn it into fun. I'll make a joke out of it. But at the same time, it would be a joke that I hope is kind of therapeutic. You know, the idea was to take all the shit of the world and turn it into an inoculation. And that was the metaphor for it. If I could take all this horrible stuff and turn it into the sugar that makes the medicine go down and give people a hit of all this terrible stuff about the 21st century, the porn addiction, you know, the violence, the cruelty, the stupidity, but put it in this one story as a hit. And that was the notion, I could inoculate my readers against the 21st century. So I still advise people to go and read The Filth if you want to be inoculated against the 21st century. And I love it because it just goes to dark places, but it finds beauty the darker it goes. And I loved it because I was on the journey myself, you know, and just getting to deeper and deeper into that beer. And it's just standing there with the shit in your hands. And that's what I do with this. It's just spread it on your flowers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah,
it goes so well with The Invisibles, right? Because like you said, like The Invisibles is kind of like the ecstatic high. And The Filth is, you know, the morning after.
Yeah, it's the come down after the MDMA.
Yeah,
The Filth is quite funny, and I did it deliberately, and it's super surreal, you know, giant sperm, and it's kind of it was deliberately designed to be like one of those old Irwin Allen shows, you know, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea or Lost in Space, where every week there's a new monster. Mm. But the monsters in this were really just personifications of everything I saw kind of going wrong in culture at the start of the 21st century, and a lot of it, I think, has been borne out by what actually happened, you know, and the deleterious effects of things like porn and the online world, which we're now seeing in younger kids who've been quite bizarrely affected by all that and are quite weird because of it.
Right on. And, just some of the things that you get into with The Filth and, you know, it's really nice how you have these areas that you've explored throughout all your works over your career. You know, much like Robert Anton Wilson, you know, it's an inexhaustible exploration. Your ability to, you know, keep unpacking these major concepts that I feel like you sort of downloaded through your own personal experiences throughout your career. And then your unpacking of these things in all these different forms is what makes your work so fun to read, you know? And so how you worked with these themes in The Filth is something that really, I mean, for me, it's your work for me, it's The Invisibles and The Filth are just like really great, you know, some of my favorites. And, but, you know, I really love this notion of course, you know, you look at how, you know, the blurring of the fourth wall, right, within mm-hmm. the comic book, but then that blurring of the fourth wall is pretty much just almost like this collapse of the 32nd path as well, where, you know, the mm-hmm. tenuous line between imagination and reality is, you know, more porous than ever. And isn't that magic, of course, the ability to change reality through your, you know, will and imagination and whatnot. But I just really like the way that you explored as well, like this notion of layering of realities, you know, how the main character, Greg Feeley, you know, has these organisms within his, you know, little mm-hmm. bottle, and he really loves them. And, you know, and he's just dealing with so much grief. I think that's what makes it such a cathartic read, is that here you have, you know, you take King Mob, who is, you know, something you want to be. And then Greg Feeley is the guy that, like, this pathetic guy, but who really feels so much, you know, that's, and I think that's what makes him such a great hero. But,
and I think he's also, you can see him as King Mob, you know, I mean, I wanted part of it to be like, the way that, and I don't know how much you know, you get the reference, but the Patrick McGoohan's original series was Secret Agent Man, which we knew as Danger Man in Britain. And then he did The Prisoner. And, you know, The Prisoner's the super cool fucking psychedelic spy show to end them all. But it's like a sequel to Danger Man, because the character he plays in The Prisoner, even though he's only known as Number Six, it's kind of the spy, John Drake, from Danger Man for Secret Agent Man. So I kind of wanted that relationship between the Invisibles and the Filth as well. It's like suddenly this could be King Mob, you know, like lost in the Clip-Off or lost in an identity, and suddenly it's that life. And there's even a little bit in the Invisibles where there's King Mob's been affected by the kind of the magic mirror that the bad guys are using, the kind of psychic poison. And he actually sees himself, and it looks like Greg Feeley, and Chris Weston drew the sequence, you know, and it's King Mob sitting, he's kind of overweight, and he's sitting there with a beer in his hand just watching TV, and the TV's just got a huge eye watching him back, and there's pipes coming out of his head, just funneling away all his thoughts. And that's really where the Filth kind of grew out of that one picture of here's King Mob fucked, you know, after the battles have been lost, and he's just sitting watching TV.
Yeah. And, you know, another character that stands out from that series is Spartacus Hughes, right? Mm. He's the sort of shapeshifter, the body hopping rogue, the other. So to give a little backstory, Greg Feeley is, you know, lost in an identity, but he's part of a secret organization called The Hand, AKA The Filth. And their role, the Hand's role, is to keep society on the path towards status quo. Is that
right? That's it, yeah.
Old status
quo. So they're also, I mean, the hand, they call themselves, we are the hand that wipes the ass of the world. And they kind of, they're the garbage men of the world, you know, and they kind of, they go about in secret and they get rid of all the shit that might affect the running of the world and the way of keeping everything on the straight and narrow and on the level. So they get rid of anomalies and weird stuff and people that don't fit. But the whole thing was originally, the idea was to do a kind of metaphor of biology. So I was really into the immune system, and the immune system is these five different types of cells. So you've hunter-killer cells, you have, you know, T cells, you have the various bunch of them, like macrophages and those things. And so the Hand organization was based in that. Each one of them represents a different type of cell. So Greg Feeley he's the in the Hand organization, he's part of the Palm, and the Palm is the kind of, they're the good guys, they're the negotiators, because the Palm's an open-handed gesture. The fist are the fighters, and the horns are the occult division. So stuff like that. They all, there's five different divisions, and he's a negotiator. So that was, he's like a helper T cell. And the others are like, you know, like they're like killer, hunter killer cells, if you're part of the horns or the fist. So that was the idea, and the whole thing is just this metaphor. I wanted to turn my own immune system into this kind of spy-fi organization, mm-hmm. and give it a voice and see and start talking about all this stuff that was going on within my own body. And the idea of my own body has been the republic of the story, really, and that I was kind of, I figured if I could talk to my own immune system through the through these characters, I could kind of form my relationship with it and maybe make sure that I stayed healthy. So I had these kind of magical ideas about how I could use this to talk to my immune system. And so it played out. And the interesting thing that I discovered is, look, when I was really doing all my research and discovering about mitochondria, and obviously the mitochondria, the mother cell, and it's a cell that developed like 3.5 billion years ago. It's the first living cell. And it's been dividing ever since. And every single living thing contains a division of the mother cell. So as we spoke about, when I talked to you before, when I had my experience in Kathmandu, in this sense of everything being connected and not in an abstract way, but in a very literal way through time, because we were all connected by the mitochondria. So it's still dividing right now in our bodies. It was dividing all those years ago when we had our first interview. It's still dividing. And it's dividing in every single living thing on the planet. So I began to think, well, wouldn't the mitochondria then fill the space of what we like to call a soul? Because the mitochondria is a physical entity that exists in all of us, but it's immortal. It's been around since it is the beginning of life on Earth. It is the progenitor of life on Earth. I imagine if you're billions of years old and you're distributed through every single life form on Earth, you probably have some kind of consciousness. And so I figured that sense of an indwelling immortal self is our sense of the mitochondria and how it feels about its own existence. And that we do have, within every cell in the body, within it all, every part of us, we have a connection to this eternal thing. So for me, when I was doing the filth, I started to realise there are physical explanations for everything that's been, you know, that is seen as spiritual or religious. I can find an actual physical correlate for all of that. And that's where my magical system really, really is kind of flowered for me, because I began to understand that magic only is real if all of it can be played down here in the material world. And magic has to work in Malkut. You know, you can do magic in Yesus. You can go into the astral plane, go anywhere you like. You can hang out with any god you want.
Yeah.
But unless you bring it back, that's all it is. You know, it's the astral plane. It's the imagination. You've either got to write a book or you've got to do something with that. If you don't do it, it's worthless. So for me, there was that understanding that everything about magic should also be explicable in the material universe, which... And that's kind of what the filth gave me. And that's when I began to understand how magic really works and what it is and how it affects consciousness and how it's purely physical as well as having all these dimensions of you know, the astral, the mental, the psychic, the spiritual, whichever, all the way up to non-dual consciousness. And so that was the big thing the filth gave me, is that absolute connection to the dirt and the ooze and the mess and the things that die and are mortal but are actually the expressions of an immortal intelligence.
Mm. Very, very nice, man. Nicely put. Yeah, that's like a really interesting like branch of narrative medicine as well. You know, this notion of giving a story to your... you know, your state. I guess they use it mostly for illnesses, but, you know, applying it to absolutely everything is
brilliant. It just gives you a different... To have a dialogue with things, I think, is important. You know, the universe, as I've said before, it likes to dance, and so you've got to dance, and if you dance, it dances back. And it's always good to form a dialogue, you know, because then once the universe starts dancing with you, weird things happen, interesting coincidences happen, synchronicities, things that look like the supernatural, but they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like this too, because you're pretty much forwarding a method for, you know, the magic of writing and imagination, right? By giving voice to, you know, you create the conversation through a dialogue through characters on the page. Yeah. Yeah. And very magical and Yeah, because it could help with some sort of resolution. Yeah, that one is.
Yeah,
not-
and you can set a narrative, and that was my idea for the hyper sigil, was that you could put a desire or a notion into a narrative, and that would allow it to come into conflict with, you know, anti-narratives and the way that stories work. It's suddenly the good guy meets the bad guy. Suddenly there's a, you know, there's a time limit. There's something's got to happen. And if you apply that to something, you get a really different, you know, much more multidimensional view of it. So definitely, you know, adding narrative to something allows you to, like I say, to dance with it, to have a process.
How did your approach differ in terms of writing the filth versus the invisibles in terms of accessing, like you said, you're accessing your body. I mean, are you going through your own personal traumas and working it out on the page? Like, are you, as opposed to the invisibles where it's like, nah, man, you know, we got to stay focused on party time. Like what, give us a look.
Yeah, the invisibles went, was longer, obviously. Invisibles lasted 6 years, you know, and it was like a diary. So I was doing all that stuff and I was changing quite rapidly in those years. You know, I kind of went from one version of myself to something quite different. So that had a more diaristic quality. And as you say, yeah, it was way more upbeat. The 90s were great. I had a brilliant time. You know, I was having a lot of fun and traveling and doing a lot of cool shit. So that was all there. All that vibe is in there. You know, it's got a fizzing quality to it, and there's a real optimism and an upbeat feel. And I still honestly, I believe that optimism is the fundamental quality of the universe. You know, it's just that but we get hit with all this other crap. So the filth was a way of looking at all that crap. And as I say, I could only do it because I was having a good time in my life. But at the same time, yeah, my dad had just died, you know, so that was difficult. My cat was dying just like the cat in the story, so that was hardcore. And I just thought, well, I'll be able to look at this stuff because everything else is going so well, really. And I kind of exposed myself to everything, you know, horrible. I read up about death and working in mortuaries. I was like, and everything, you know, just everything horrible. And I was looking at a bunch of porn online and just the seedy, kind of crappy nature of that stuff. And so I was absorbing a lot of it and it was bringing me down, you know, a bit. So it's why the filth is funny. The filth is kind of Python-esque, you know, because I thought it was the only way to deal with that toxic material was to kind of take the piss out of it. And for me to not be caught up in it was to take that distance, and everything's stupid in it. You know, everybody's desires are just stupid and small and backwards. And so there's a sense of not being caught in the filth of it, you know. But for me, there was a real, I was getting close, you know, there was a closeness to stuff that was just giving me the creeps and weirding me out and just looking, like I say, looking at mortality, looking at dark side of stuff, looking at what people really do to each other, you know, rather than what I wanted them to be in the Invisibles.
Mm, yeah, very well put. Yeah, and I think, you know, the character Spartacus Hughes sort of encapsulates some of the worst of that. He's sort of like this mix between like Epstein and Steve Bannon, right? Like living on some yacht, trying to, I don't know, impregnate thousands of... young.
Well, what Spartacus used was the idea of a viral man. You know, it just seemed like a really good spy notion. But so as you said, I mean, Greg Feeley in the story, he seems like this normal guy who's a cat, a sick cat. And then we discover that, no, he's not. Greg Feeley is a para-persona. And a para-persona is a fake personality that you basically inject and you become someone else. But who he really is Ned Slade, who's this big-time negotiator, tough guy from The Hand. Or so they tell him, you know. So I had this notion of just the personality itself being viral, being transmissible. And I thought, if he's this alleged para-persona, then what happens to a rogue para-persona that gets out and can replicate itself through lots of bodies? And that's what Spartacus Hughes became. So you see him as a different guy each time, you know, because the virus, the personality that is just a virus, has moved on to a new host. And I just thought, he was a great character. I loved him because he's just a bastard, you know, and it's like the idea of how a virus might look at us.
You told me that you contacted the COVID virus during that time, utilizing psychedelics and sort of your own type of meditation. What, just very briefly wondering, what sort of words of wisdom did the COVID virus have for us?
It's hard to say, but I noticed that it wasn't even so much that I contacted it. It contacted me because it felt so weird when I got it.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, this isn't normal, you know? I'm having really profound kind of depression, but I know it's not my depression. It was like synthetic depression. It was like AI depression, you know, like a machine trying to do human depression. I'm kind of, I was very aware of it as an organism because I'd never experienced it before. It was something new. It's not like the flu or the cold or those things that we're kind of used to because you had them when you were a kid or you've had them growing up. This was a completely novel organism, and it was in my body. And so I was very aware, and I was kind of, like I was trying to do my sort of techniques for getting down and talking to things. And I was aware of this, it was purple, and these kind of like purple and frothing kind of intelligence that I was getting. And it felt synthetic. It didn't feel like it was an actual real thing. But that's only how it felt. I mean, it may just, it was alien. I'd never met something like it before. But there was a plastic quality to it, purple plastic. You know, I've got kind of synesthesia. And for me, it was this real sense, like ultraviolet deep. And it was talking, and it was kind of trying to manipulate me, and it was trying to find ways in. I was really very aware of this thing probing my defences and trying to get under and trying to figure out what to do. So I have the feeling that, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying it's a synthetic organism or it's a being created or anything. I don't know. I mean, I know there are lots of conspiracy theories and ideas about that. I just don't know, but that's how it felt to me. And so I began to really think that it's responsible for a lot more than we're giving it credit for, because since it's been around, the world has descended into fucking chaos. Mm. And I think a lot of that's what COVID does to us. COVID makes people crazy in the exact way that we're seeing it playing out. And because it affected people with a lot of power, you know, Putin invades Ukraine right after coming out of 2 years of isolation, pretty much. You know, you get, everyone forms these mad ideas in isolation and suddenly unleashes them on the world. And I just wonder, as I say, how much of that is the germ and how much of it is us?
That's deep, Grant.
Yeah, and it's like I said in The Filth as well, like we are composed of bacteria, and much of our body mass is bacteria. I mean, in The Filth, it gives an erroneous calculation that was the one from 20 years ago, where it was like one in every 10, or every human cell has 10 bacteria. So your body's mostly bacteria. It's not quite as many as that, but they outnumber us. So in The Filth, it says, how much of your thought is their thought? Can you be sure? You know, when you feel depressed, when these bad things come into your head and you put yourself down and you see yourself in a bad light, and you is that them talking or is it really you? You know, and again, it goes back to that thing in the Invisibles issue too, where the King Mob's disguised and he's up in a box just shouting at the passers-by, when was the last time you had a thought that wasn't put there by them? Mm. And I think it's a really important question for us all.
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, I mean, there's been, you know, scientific research linking air pollution and violence in teenagers. So it's real. Yeah, I believe.
Yeah, and like microplastics and the effects of that stuff. I mean, everyone's riddled with that, you know. So again, we're under a lot of influences, and in a lot of cases, they're invisible influences. They're not understood. They're not only physical influences, psychological influences, or weird cultural influences that people are barely aware of that cause all kinds of things. You know, that like there's the West has a mental health crisis, particularly in young people. And I think that's part of all of this as well. You know, I think that mental health crisis is an outgrowth of an obsession with individuality and an obsession with isolation and obsession with simulation and synthetic things. and it's naturally messing people up, but it doesn't get understood in that way. People tend to think there are very simple explanations for these things when it's not as simple. It's not just they're watching bad shit on the internet. It's like the entire culture is coming at you from every direction in a lot of toxic ways.
I love how you ground your magical research in biology and the science mm-hmm. of biology, and you know, seek explanations within biology for these, you know, sort of spooky happenings. And I know Robert Anton Wilson, he liked to utilize physics and quantum physics mm-hmm. to find explanations, and that's why, you know, say reading some of him and some of what you're talking about go together so well. So yeah, magic as a result of biology. So then magic can affect our biology. Does that correlation ring true? I mean,
yeah, but again, I mean, it's a very obvious thing. You know, if you bring it back down, you could sit and meditate and align your chakras and do all that stuff. But if you just sit there, you're going to end up kind of slobbing out, you know? So you could go and do all your chakras and go out walking and do all this other stuff. You know, it's the participation in the universe has to be on all levels for it really to be exciting and for it really to work. So it's kind of more like that. You know, it has to work physically. It has to work in yes odds. I mean, I'm using the Kabbalistic Tree of Life here because it's got a useful map of how magical consciousness develops. So you're starting with the material world. You get up to the world of the imagination, the astral plane, which is infinite. You know, inside your skull is anything can happen. You can pack universes in there. Then you get up to Hod, which is the realm of language and communication, and that's where reason is and maths and all the languages and the ways that we've formed the world into codes and ciphers and notions and structures and patterns. Then you go over to Netzach, which is emotions, and it's all the entire realm of emotions. So those initial parts of the tree of life have to be kind of balanced before you start really becoming a magician. But it all does work, you know, and it all has to work. If it doesn't work in the material world, you can just get lost. You see a lot of those magicians who are wandering about with their big capes on and their rings and their staffs and trying to be that guy, you know, and they're caught up in the image of the magician, which is a Hod level, the notion of image and performance and presentation. And you can see people caught there, or you'll see other people caught in the Esod, where their magic is all happening in their heads. And that's fine if you happen to be a writer or a musician or someone who can then bring it out of your head. But unless you can bring it down, it's just not functioning, you know. So as you say, yeah, for me, magic's got to have the physical component. It has to work. And yeah, I mean, you can tune biology, of course you can, but we know this. You can tune it by using, you know, sort of Tibetan or Indian methods of vocalizations and those chakra meditations and stuff. But as I say, you've also got to go out running or walking or doing other stuff or doing Tai Chi or doing martial arts and bring it into the physical, or doing yoga or something like that. And we know how this is done. We know how to improve your body. That's how you do it. So if you want to magic up your body, then you train and you eat the best food and you do the right stuff to make it as an optimum physical frame. And that's magic. That would be the magic of the physical.
Mm, I like
that. And you're doing the same for your head. You're doing, at the same time you're developing your imagination and your creativity, at the same time you're developing your reasoning by reading and understanding, at the same time you're developing your emotions and your empathy and your understanding of people on that level, and then you're going up to the higher parts of the tree of life and, as I say, moving towards a non-dual consciousness, which is like God intelligence, where it all the divisions just collapse into unity, as they say. Mm. And so, but even up there, that highest state has to also have a correlation in the physical world, and you'll see it, you'll feel better, you know, you glow a bit more as things will happen around you. You have charisma. Once you reach hod in the tree life, you can develop charisma and be like Jesus and talk, and people will listen and think that, you know, as I said earlier, you could send them to war, or you could make them dance, or you could make them, you know, into artists just by talking at them the right way.
Yeah. And, you know, listening to your explanation of, you know, preparation for, say, the magical path and whatnot, you know, it sounds very similar, of course, to, you know, Aleister Crowley's prescription for working the path. But, you know, Crowley emphasized the first major step needing to be contact with your holy guardian angel. Yeah, that's something I've been thinking a lot about recently, you know, wondering, well, I think I had a contact with my HGA. And, you know, of course, it becomes that, especially afterwards, this sort of state, because mine wasn't within a thelemic sort of path. It was this kind of spontaneous, yeah, shamanic, psychedelic, like kind of what have you. But, you know, how much do you think about that? You know, like Crowley said, and you can, you know, confirm or deny that this was his major emphasis in his work, was to lead people to the knowledge and conversation of their holy guardian angel. Does that ever inform any of your work, like a desire that you hope that this book will like truly inspire people to move towards like, you know, their highest?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, my book, because all of my magic has been reflected in the work that I've done. So as I've gone through these, you know, the magician's path, as they call it, on the Tree of Life, it's that kind of lightning zigzag that goes up and it hits every sephira, every sphere on the Tree of Life. So I've got work for all of them. And the work for me that was in the Holy Guardian Angel space was the Invisibles. And it was just the central, because the Holy Guardian Angel is it's like the central sun of yourself, you know, the Holy Guardian Angel. It's not, everyone's got a take on it. I think it's a future self, in the sense that when you're a little kid, before the age of three, you don't have self-consciousness. They say, I mean, I remember shit from before the age of three, but by and large, we don't have major self-conscious awareness before the age of three. And after that time, kids before the age of three can't see perspective. They don't, you can't draw a perspective on, they don't have the thing in their head. The head hasn't developed properly. They don't have self-awareness. But the interesting thing is, at the age of three, kids have imaginary friends. And I know this. I had one when I was a kid. And age of three is when imaginary friends start to appear. And for me, the imaginary friend is simply, it's the voice that appears in your head. You suddenly become aware that you have an internal dialogue. But because you've never heard it before or never paid attention to it before, it seems like it's coming from outside, or that it's someone else's voice talking in your head. And so for a while, you separate it out, and it can become seen as an independent being, or you can put it into one of your toys, or, you know, and it becomes a thing. You have conversations, and it seems like a real entity. And then slowly it disappears, and it's like, oh, it's gone. What happened to it? And all that's happened to it is it becomes integrated. It's around so often that it becomes normalized, and it just becomes part of your own personality. So I think the Holy Guardian Angel, and it can appear spontaneously, or you can do the Crowley Bornless ritual and make it appear. The Holy Guardian Angel is that. It's the next stage of consciousness above the one you're at. And it's the magician consciousness. And it comes on, and it feels like an alien contact. It's so unusual. It's like something you've never had before. It's a perspective which is five-dimensional. So you've never experienced it before, and it comes on like you have been abducted by aliens, or touched by angels, or raped by demons if you happen to be in a bad state of mind. You know? But that's what happens. It feels like it's from outside. It's an external force. But I actually believe it's just the activation of the next circuit, or whatever. I mean, what would Raw call it? It's the neurosomatic or whatever one.
The metaprogramming.
Yeah, so it's the activation of that next circuit, but it comes on like alien contact because it's so novel and you've never experienced it before. So that's my take on what the Holy Guardian Angel actually is. It's the future self when you've become integrated with the Holy Guardian Angel. And Crowley and the Selamites basically talk about the angel abandons you when you get to the abyss, and you have to cross the abyss alone and without the aid of your angel. And for me, that's when the angel just becomes fully integrated. That's why it's no longer, you're naked and alone because you are now the angel, and it's not there to protect you anymore. You are it, and you have to face the abyss as your own future self. So that's my take on it. And I think, I mean, Crowley, I don't think it's not something that happens initially. I think definitely early in your magical career, you have a spontaneous experience of it. But for me, it didn't happen until like 1994, and I did the Bornless ritual and made it, and it descended onto me. At least when I got to Kathmandu, the whole thing just came in, you know, and it wasn't, that came after doing rituals, months after doing rituals. But that was it for me, and it was recognisable specifically because you have a vision of Christ and you understand Christ. So if you haven't had this vision of Christ, then you know you've not had the Holy Guardian Angel.
Curious though, very quick, did you work a program, say, like how the Crowley curriculum of invoking these other deities along the way, like Newt, and did you work that?
Nah, I mean, I was very punk about magic, you know. I went into it and I was influenced by the Chaos Magicians in Leeds, and that was the first stuff that I discovered, was like Ray Sherwin and Peter Carroll's stuff.
Okay.
So I came at it from that side, and sort of William Burroughs and that slightly more mental end of magic. So for me, it was quite punk. It was just like diving into the jungle. And so I was a very skeptical kid, and nothing interesting like that had ever happened to me. So it was just like, okay, this guy says if I do this and this and this, it will work. Okay, I'll do it. And it did work. And that was all it took, was, okay, that worked. I'm a skeptic, now I'm not. And just doing more and more of it. But I wasn't following Crowley. My uncle Billy, who got me into it, gave me Crowley's books, but I found them quite difficult to read. I preferred the chaos magic stuff because it was contemporary. Mm-hmm. So that was really where I was getting it from, and they were borrowing from everywhere. So I was taking rituals from, you know, I'd pick up a book about Mexican magic, you know, oh, okay, I'll try that one, or voodoo, or Celtic stuff, or I was bringing it in from everywhere. And it was only later when I realised that what magic is really, it's just about changing consciousness. And all these methods are just ways of changing consciousness and getting you to a state where it feels like a god is in the room or a demon is in the room. And so I'd studied just 1,000 different methods of doing it and realised that underlying it was all just the same thing, you know, and these were all just like art styles, you know, like art approaches like surrealism and impressionism and all the different forms of magic, but it's all just magic underneath. It's just art. It's just the expression of something that's quite simple underneath.
You know, a magician, shouldn't reveal too many of his tricks, but I mean...
No, I think he should, honestly. I'm the one that says reveal everything. Because that makes it even more magical then.
So this is my question then, man. So, yeah. So you're speaking about then like this sort of eclectic, esoteric, you know, Bushido that you're putting together. Mm-hmm. And like, did you invoke often though? Did you mm-hmm. practice that invocation thing? So you pick different sort of traditions, like somewhere from the Mexicans, and then the Loa, you told me about that.
Big contact with Papagede, you know, the graveyard god, the sort of Papa, what's his name? Papagede.
Yeah.
He's got another name as well, Baron Samedi.
Yes.
Is the other name. So I got a really great relationship with that god. I mean, I really get on with that character. It's why he went into the Invisibles and became the Jim Crow character, became an avatar of Papagede. But that led me into some dark stuff with the scorpions, the voodoo scorpion lore. So I kind of backed out then. But yeah, and I was doing a lot of Shiva and Ganesh. Ganesh is still my patron, you know, that's my patron god. And a lot of that stuff, like the Indian stuff and Tibetan deities and that. So I would kind of go for things that seemed really intense or powerful. And I did a lot of summoning demons and had a lot of mad arguments with demons. The demons were fun, you know, but they leave you feeling like filthy. But they're really, they like to argue and logic and dissembling. And so I always found it fun. But yeah, I was summoning all the time. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I did like John Lennon. I was doing Jack Kirby's Metron from the New Gods or the Flash from the comics. But the Flash and Metron were just avatars of Mercury or Hermes or Ganesh, which again, the god of communication. So all as I say, all you're doing is summoning a state of mind, a state of consciousness. And that state of consciousness can be embodied by anything that is appropriate for you. You know, you might want, if you summon up the god of speed and communication, you might get Sonic the Hedgehog or Speedy Gonzalez. If those forms talk to you better than, you know, Hermes or Ganesh or Ogma of the Celts.
And were you working then with like the Lesser Key of Solomon, Goetia, in terms of summoning these demons, or was it?
I was totally free form. It was like shamanic, you know. I wasn't following it. The one I did was the Bornless Crowley thing, but I tended not to follow like rituals to the letter. I kind of figured out the basis of them, and then I would just create my own. And I'd just open the doors to these things and call them in and see what happened. Mm.
But you would work a structure in the sense that you would start with the lesser banishing ritual, perhaps, right?
Yeah, I would do banishings and stuff, but I went through a lot where I just didn't banish at the end.
Oh, okay, right.
And I just kept the atmosphere, and then I would write, you know, I'd put stuff in stories, and that seemed to do the banishing for me, but I didn't do a formal banishing for like 10 years of doing magic. Mm. People will probably say, that's why you're insane. But I don't know. But I'm not. I'm radiantly sane. <You know?
clears throat> Oh, I love it. And so, but you kind of eventually, maybe turning a corner. I don't know if that's quite the phrase, but almost like a lot like Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson, in a way. Like, you know, he dived deep for a number of years into it, got the results that he got, and seemed to integrate it. And then just he moved to Ireland. I don't think he was in any OTO stuff out there. Just writing, and Guinness and Jameson, just writing. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And when I speak with you, it strikes me as you struck a similar path, in the sense that like you were so intensely into it, you know, like you were like a paragon of chaos magic. And I think you still are. You have so much to teach and unpacking your stuff. But from what you've told me, like you've just concentrated, like the work became the magic even more, right? Mm. Like, and I mean, that seems to be part of a method.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone goes through a thing like that. You know, it's like if you look at David Bowie in Los Angeles, where he was doing tons of magic and taking tons of coke and making music. Or you look at Burroughs and Brian Gysin in the Beat Hotel in 1963 doing tons of magic. And I think
tons of heroin.
Yeah, tons of heroin. There's always something like that, you know. So I think there are these moments in life. And for me, it was, you know, I'd split up from my long-term girlfriend, and I was kind of footloose, and I'd just traveled around the world on my own. So I was exploding, you know, and I was getting into so much stuff that I'd never really got into before. So it was a big time for me to absorb new influences. And I think there's just that time where you really go for it, you know, and you've got the space. I was on my own. I had to decorate my house like a temple if I felt like it, and like my girlfriend wasn't going to stop me. So it was just me and the cats, and me going like just going to the furthest limits of my being in that house. So I think there are times where you can do that, you know, and I think there are moments where you can do that, and other times where it's not that. And for me, then the magic became, like I said, it became integrated. It became part of what I was doing. So everything became magic. Like opening a door became like, oh, that would connect to some symbol in my head or some story or some myth. Or, you know, so everything became that. And especially the work became more expressive of the magical intent. It became a lot easier to do. It's like anything I wanted to do, I could suddenly do it in a way that I couldn't before. So as I say, I felt that it all became integrated. It became, I guess, like if you're learning guitar or you're a martial artist, you go through a really intense period at the start where you're obsessed, you know, and then suddenly you look back and you go, oh, I'm so used to playing a G chord now. I don't remember the magic of the first time I was able to play a G chord because you've just, you know, you've integrated it all. And the dazzling nature of it, the pyrotechnic nature of learning and experiencing for the first time isn't there anymore. So it does become a lot, not necessarily gentler, it just becomes deeper, you know, and magic soaks into everything.
What role do cats play in your magical path, man?
So always making a noise in the background, that's the role they play. I don't know, they just, cats came to me and then I've become obsessed by them over decades and suddenly that's it, I'm surrounded by them. And my other, obviously Ganesh is my central patron, you know, that's my writer god, and he kind of chose me when I was in India. But Bast is the other one that I have on my altar, you know, and she sits at the top under the light. So Bast is kind of the number one, really. And I think all these cats are just because all that too much worship of cats, too much worship of Bast, and too much kind of masturbation magic at the same time over many years has ended up with me being surrounded by millions of kittens that I think have psychically impregnated their mothers.
Yeah, you have like a cat army over there, yeah?
No, honestly, there's like 40 of them here and even in the other place up the road, there's a ton of them have emerged. They just proliferate around me. And we're kind of concerned this year because there's a bunch of the little females are pregnant, so we could get another 30.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
But no, they've always been there. They're a kind of obvious spirit for me. You know, like Burrows had the thing with cats as well. And I think they've just always been this kind of spirit creature. They're always there when I'm working. They always find their way into my stories as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm not too versed on, you know, the role of within the Egyptian lore of Bast. What was that deity? What magical power did that deity have?
Oh, she's got a lot of things, you know. She's a very powerful goddess. And you imagine now with the internet and lolcats and cat memes, she must be the most powerful goddess on earth currently. So no, she's very powerful, but mostly, you know, she's the goddess of cats.
What can we learn from her?
She had her own city, she had her own shit, you know. It was like, that's why they mummified cats and they took cats very seriously.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say that we're in that phase now, I guess, where the cat is taking over. And I'm wondering what can I learn from these wonderful creatures that, you know, I feed in the parking lot of my apartment, you know?
Oh my God, no, they're great. They're just the way that they handle everything. They just get on with stuff, you know, and they don't really complain much, but they're like ninjas, you know, and they have different personalities. So observing them is really useful to learn about just how other consciousness works. You know, and a lot of people just write them off and do they're just dumb animals, but they're not. You watch them all and they're all very distinct and their personalities are really specific. So they're good to observe and they're just good to learn from. They're great meditators, you know, and they'll just sit and they'll stalk their prey, which is good for magicians because you want to stalk your prey and oftentimes your prey is yourself. So you need to be still and you need to watch for your own movements and habits and then destroy them when they're getting in your way.
Magic works.
Fuck, man. Hey!
Thank you again to Grant Morrison. You can stay in tune with Grant's newest creative endeavors on the Substack page, grantmorrison.substack.com. Also, be sure to check out my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, available on my website, chapelperilous.us. And please consider contributing to my Patreon page. The handle is propanon2323. And lastly, consider becoming a paid subscriber to my Substack page as well, at gabrielpatrickkennedy.substack.com. Until next time, peace out.
You've been listening to the Propanon Podcast on the fucking internet.